Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of The Moonalogues. Hello world, hello change. I hope you're doing good. I don't know when you're listening to this, but I hope you had a chance to smile at the world and that the world had a chance to smile at you. And if not yet, well, there is still time left, right? It's never too late to smile. In today's episode, we're going to have a look at the root of civilization. And if you think this is going to be an in-depth philosophical discourse, which I'd be totally up for, well, we're not going to do this in this episode. Who knows what the future brings? And the stories we're going to hear today come from Lebanon and various corners of the world. And I think there is nothing left to say except for, let's do this. It is cold on this day at the end of August. In theory, it is still summer. In real life, it is 13 degrees Celsius, that's about 55 Fahrenheit. The sky is grey, and some of the clouds are so dark as if they wanted to exclude any possibility of sunlight forever. As I ride to work on my red bike, I ask myself what I want to talk about in the upcoming episode of the Moonalogues. It feels more like, what can I talk about? I must confess that this time it is not so easy for me to find a story that makes me smile, that brings some optimism. For it seems that everywhere I look, negative news dominate, even more than usual. In the last 18 months, many organizations that were based on bridging social gaps and having people meet in order to form connections have been closed down. Because building a connection and building bridges was only considered to be safe at a distance. But what is a civilization worth that only lives at a distance? Margaret Mead was a controversial American anthropologist. She was born in 1902 and died in 1978. She made a name for herself with her research in the context of cultural studies and is also considered to be a pioneer of the sexual revolution. Go, Margaret! In any case, in her work, she was primarily concerned with Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. And in this context, she explored the question of how social behavior arises. Is it learned and therefore dependent on culture or not? Ira Byock is a physician and author also from the US, and he retells the following story of Margaret Mead in his book The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. According to him, Margaret Mead was asked by a student what she thought was the first sign of civilization in a culture. The student expected Mead to talk about fish hooks, clay pots, or grinding stones. After all, according to the conviction in academia at that time, tools are indicators of settlement, and this in turn is a condition for building a civilization. But Margaret Mead was not talking about tools, weapons, or the cultivation of food. Instead, the anthropologist said that the first sign of civilization in an ancient culture was a thigh bone that had been broken and then healed. She explained that in the animal kingdom, if you break your leg, you die. You can no longer run away from danger, go to the river to drink, or hunt for food. Basically, you are meat for stray animals. No animal survives a broken leg long enough for the bone to heal. A broken femur that has healed is proof that someone took the time to stay with the one who fell, bandage the wound, move the person to safety, and care for them while they recovered. Helping someone in trouble is the beginning of civilization, said Margaret Mead. And Ira Byock ends the story about Mead by saying, we are best when we serve others. Be civilized. And a bell in my head goes ding, 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 because I start to remember stories where people are civilized, where people stay, care, and serve others. The first of these stories takes us to Lebanon, the smallest country in continental Asia. To Beirut, to be exact. Perhaps some of you may have heard of the project that I'm going to talk about, But because of the recent developments in Afghanistan, it is a project that gives me hope. Because it is a project that functions as a sign for human resilience. It all started a little over a year ago, on the 5th of August 2020, the morning after the explosion in the port of Beirut. An explosion that took the lives of more than 200 people, injured 6,500, and left more than 300,000 homeless overnight. That morning, about a handful of people from the neighborhood gathered at an abandoned petrol station near Al Rum Hospital. The hospital itself is located in close proximity to the Jardin des Jesuites, but it was neither the Jesuit garden nor the Al Rum Hospital that made the small group of neighbors spontaneously gather at the petrol station. The point was to take stock of their devastated neighborhood. What was needed? What should be done first? And above all, what could they do? After all, there was only chaos and confusion everywhere. The group decided to take it one step at a time, first distributing food to the people to at least alleviate some of their despair. Mazen El-Moor was one of the neighbors who showed up at the petrol station that Wednesday morning. After the explosion, I realized that I could give even more to my country than I thought, the now 30-year-old architect says. I still had a spark of hope then and enough strength to tackle the challenges ahead. He got active, even while his own flat had been badly damaged in the catastrophe. And there was much to be done. First of all, they rebuilt the petrol station because the explosion had torn down the walls here as well. Within a few days, the former car wash was transformed into a kitchen and the neighborhood group had found their headquarters. And so the story of the community project Nation Station began. Nation Station received donations from developmental aid organizations and private individuals. The sink, for instance, that is now in the kitchen, was originally in a restaurant that had been destroyed by the explosion. In addition to donations, there were also numerous helpers from home and abroad, up to 100 at one point. These days, the number has leveled off at about 30 helpers. Josephine Abu Abdo is one of the co-founders of Nation Station. Before the disaster, she worked as a designer. Now, like the others in the core team, she works part-time as a freelancer to support herself. The rest of the time, she takes care of the community kitchen. The kitchen provides 150 hot meals 3 times a week, and they distribute the food, typical Lebanese meals, to the neighborhood. The names of those who receive a warm meal are written on a big board in the community kitchen. Names written in green belong to those who are too old, sick, or otherwise physically unable to collect the food themselves. The names written in black belong to those who come with their own containers. The volunteers in the kitchen pack the food into set containers and people take it home. Half of the Lebanese people live below the poverty line. The price of bread alone has increased 3 times in the last year. There are hardly any jobs. The food that Nation Station offers is essential for many people in the city. In addition to food, people can also receive clothing, psychological care, and medical treatment. Young doctors are handling the medical support. One of them is Wael Yomes. The 26-year-old examines sick people and gives them medical advice because those who no longer have a job cannot afford treatment. But the project wants to be more than an NGO. Nation Station has rebuilt 80 houses in the last year and is developing into a self-supporting community center. Josephine Abu Abdul remembers, "In the beginning, people were totally skeptical. They thought we wouldn't stay. But now that they see us every day, we are gaining their trust. We also visit them sometimes or call to make sure they are okay." Rather than just providing temporary help to those affected, Nation Station focuses on empowerment instead of charity. Nation Station has a clear aim. Rather than to provide the affected community with temporary aid or momentary relief, Nation Station provides the means and resources for long-term, self-sustaining solutions. This philosophy of community involvement is reflected throughout Nation Station's projects. Amidst the chaos of the explosion's aftermath and in the absence of competent governmental intervention, Nation Station chose a systematic approach to relief. Households are assessed by trained members of the community, street by street, building by building, case by case. The collected data is maintained and analyzed to allow for reliable help directly or through referrals to specialized NGOs. Hussein Kassoun, who also has been with the organization since day one, explains, "It's not that we are like an NGO that just comes to help and then disappears. We try to build a community. We're trying to make them feel like they're part of the change too." And Josephine Abu Abdo adds, "We thought it was over after 3 months. At first, we didn't realize that we were an alternative. An alternative for the work that should actually be done by the government. And when people look at us and see hope, we can't stop. It is our responsibility to continue." To be part of a community, that is the big goal. It answers our need to belong. But in order to be part of a community, you need to build connections. The feeling of connectivity lies at the heart of every community. Like an invisible bond, you are linked to everyone, even if you don't know everyone in that specific community. Everything begins with one-to-one connections. Connections from one person to another. And sometimes all you really need to form this bond is a simple tether or just a shoestring. The tether we are talking about here connects two runners. One is a running companion or guide. The other is a visual impaired person or VI. VI stands for visually impaired. The two athletes run the track together, whether it is just a relaxed lap of a few kilometers or a marathon. They compete as a team in races and in the Paralympics. The VI sets the pace while the guide runs at their side. The two runners are connected by the tether. The sighted athlete can use it to give direction and ensure the safety of the VI. The tether, which is typically a rope, shoestring, or strap with a loop on at both ends, is held loosely for straight tracks, but for more challenging and barrier-rich tracks, the tether is held closely so that the backs of the runner's hands and forearms touch. On narrow paths, or to have more security while running, the visually impaired person can also put their hand on the shoulder of their guide. In a race, the guide's role is to provide everything a runner with vision has, from informing the runner how far they are on the track, to where they are in comparison to the other racers, or what they must do to win. Timing is everything. The two racers must become mirror images of each other. That means that their feet have to hit the ground at the same time. It's running in unison. It is simple and yet very personal. The visually impaired person trusts his running partner, and the running partner becomes their eyes. As a guide, it is your responsibility of keeping your running partner safe. Such a running connection can trigger at least as much endorphins as winning any race. Guiding takes the self out of racing and makes it the ultimate team effort, says Caroline Gaynor from Austin, Texas. "I have been a triathlete for 15 years, and none of the races I have completed as an individual compare to the feeling I get when I cross the finish line with a visually impaired athlete. There is nothing better than knowing that you helped another person accomplish his or her goal." Adrian Broca, a visually impaired runner from Los Angeles, has the following to say about his experience with running with a guide. "Running guides have made a huge impact in my life. Not only do they generously donate their time and effort to assist me at any event, but they also pace me and motivate me to compete at a high level." The guides run and train with their partners as often as it is convenient. The VIs have several running guides, often around 8 people, with whom they go running individually. That is, if you're not training to compete in serious races. Tina Amond, a visually impaired runner from Virginia, says, "Every day of my running life, I thank my running guides. Without them, my running would be a solitary slog on a treadmill. With them, running is a chance to make new friends, to race, to be part of a great community, and to laugh, cry, and learn about people I would never have met without sport. In short, because of my guides, running brings joy and freedom." Chris Schall is an endurance athlete. His experience as a guide has made a lasting difference in his life. "Guiding a visually impaired athlete is my way of giving back to the sports that I have received so much joy from participating in," he says with a big smile on his face. As an endurance athlete, the different disciplines that we participate in are done selfishly. You train and compete by yourself. As a guide, you are able to give back to the sport by giving those with vision loss a chance to do what brings us so much joy and what that we sometimes take for granted. "After my first guiding experience, I went home and told my wife that I'm completely okay not ever doing another marathon by myself. However, I will do whatever I can to make sure that I participate year in and year out as a guide for visually impaired runners." For many running guides, tandem running is an incredible gift. It often makes them rediscover their passion for running. "After running almost 40 marathons, it was getting a little boring," admits Sydney Stutz. "The opportunity to participate as a guide reignited my passion for running. Now I can enjoy the sport I love more than ever while giving a visually impaired athlete the opportunity to do the same. It's a win-win." Eric Mansa, a visually impaired runner from Massachusetts, begs to differ though. "Even if most guides humbly disagree, I consider guiding a purely selfless act. I mean, they give up their own race and still put in the same effort just to make it possible for me to run. Just incredible people." "We are best when we serve others. Be civilized." The words of Ira Byock come back to my mind. By now, the sun has fought its way through the dark clouds. Looking up at the sky, I can still see a big, fat, dark cloud. But behind it, a white one appears, ever so brightly. And there's even a patch of deep blue sky. There are many layers up there, just like down here on this playground earth. Sometimes the dark clouds take over. But there's always a spark of light, even if it's only the certainty that behind the clouds the sun is always shining. And so I, too, always have the opportunity to be civilized. If not in big strides, then in small steps. Sometimes with a tether, sometimes without. But the chance to do something for someone else, not because I have to, but because I can, that chance is always there. Oh, wait, there's a PS. Okay, here it goes. Organizations that offer tandem running or link sighted and visually impaired athletes can be found all over the world. In Australia, China, Singapore, Spain, Norway, and Brazil, just to mention a few. If you're an avid runner and want to try out tandem running, best research some sports associations for people with disabilities or for the visually impaired in your home country. For the countries Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, the USA, Canada, Great Britain, and Germany, you can find the link to get you started for a tandem run below in the description of this episode. Just in case you want to go for a civilized run.